All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Venky. Thank you very much for the organizers for providing me this wonderful opportunity to talk about cell diversity. We heard about cell diversity, and so we're going now to dig a little bit more in cell diversity. Can you hear me, actually? It's okay?
Yeah.
Right. So thank you very much for all the efforts and to bring us here, and I'm looking forward to interact with you, so I will be here for more than 2 weeks. So, you know, if I'm going too fast today, you have more time to catch me later on. All right.
Oh yeah, interruptions will happen.
Good. That's a good sign.
This crowd? No.
Especially not you and I.
Right.
All right. So as Venky said. Now we're going to change the gear and we're going to talk about removing all these little guys here. And I'm going to show you that their lifetime is rather limited. And the question is what is the functional meaning of getting these newborn neurons, 30,000 per day in a rodent? So it's quite a lot, actually, 1%. So within 3 months, you can renew all the granule cells within the olfactory bulb. When I'm talking about adult neurogenesis, I'm just meaning that a process that is starting from stem cell divisions to cell proliferations, integrations, and survival. Most of the newborn neurons concerned by adult neurogenesis within the olfactory bulb are granule cells. And some of them, like 10% of these newborn neurons, we go to the glomerular layer and they will turn into PG cells. But my focus today will be to discuss about the functional meaning of getting these newborn neurons renewed.
Sorry, did I understand? Sure. Did you say that in 3 months all the cells will be?
In 3 months, in theory, you should be able to change the whole population of newborn neurons, of granule cells. So it's you know 1% every day arriving into the olfactory. Of course, within 2 weeks, there is like 50% of chances for these newborn neurons to die, so they don't stay forever.
There is a study in humans that shows that there is no neurogenesis.
Right. Okay, I like it. Let's start. Boom.
So
boom. You know, today is a Bastille day, huh? So I'm.
Fair warning.
Right.
You mean mice, right?
Yes.
You don't mean me, you mean mice.
Now, this is really great question. Because we have time, let me grab another presentation I had recently. Oops. This is not interesting. That's more interesting. Okay. When I'm talking about the neurogenesis in rodents, you have two places, the hippocampus and the olfactory bulb, and newborn neurons are coming from these lateral ventricles. And in human beings, you have the hippocampus here, and you have, again, these lateral ventricles. And newborn neurons are produced in the same place, so the neurogenic place is the lateral ventricles, but they don't go to the olfactory bulb. Actually, they migrate to the striatum. And interestingly, if you compare now hippocampus for the rodents, you have like a steady state of about 10% of newborn neurons. And in humans, actually, when you reach, like me, 50 years old, you have replaced all granule cells from the Dante gyruses. So you have a continuous replacement of these newborn neurons in the Dante gyruses. So in human beings, The hippocampus is actually all these neuron all these Dante gyruses, granule cells are going to be completely replaced. And there is a very interesting thing that you can do. I mean, it's just to open a discussion here. These are the proportional volumes for the olfactory bulb, as you can see with this non-primates. These are hominid, and these are the humans. And as you can see, that the proportion of the olfactory bulb goes down with the evolutions, while for the hippocampus, it's really a steady state. And interestingly, for the striatums, I mean, you have the higher volumes in human beings. I'm not going into more details, but it's very interesting because we know that rodents are using smell. And interestingly, this is a place where you have newborn neurons. And in human beings, maybe smell is not important. What is more important are motivations, hedonic values, what, you know, our daily life, where we try to reach high values of dopamine. What should I say? Okay, no, that's it, that's it. I don't want to go into more detail.
If olfactory bulb, you have no neurons in humans.
So exactly. In humans, you have a tiny numbers of newborn neurons in the olfactory bulb. The question is, where are they coming from? Because they're not coming from there is no this migratory stream, like I will describe later on in rodents. So people are starting to believe that astrocytes locally could turn into newborn neurons.
A question, in this striatum, in humans, there are newborn neurons?
This is what I was trying to tell you, yes.
You don't believe it?
No, I don't know that.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was my point. Actually, if you compare rodents and human beings, obviously, if you look at these proportional values, striatum is more important in human beings, and this is a place where you find the newborn neurons, starting from the lateral ventricles and going to the striatum.
And these are interneurons.
And they are interneurons. Yeah, biologic interneurons.
So it's more not still the importance, but the plasticity, maybe that's.
Yeah, I mean there is now a debate of what are they doing in the human striatums. So there is very very few studies, and probably there will be more now coming because these have been recently described about a year ago. Either they have something to do with motivation processes, rewards. I mean, this is really now a big question. Yes?
Two questions. So the distribution of the survival times, is this known in the olfactory bulb for the mouse? Like, do you know, are there cells, granule cells surviving full life of a mouse and then others dying over time? Or
so
more or less like
I would try, so I have some slide I didn't thought to bring them today, but maybe to answer this question rapidly, I would say that within 2 weeks after birth, these newborn granule cells in the olfactory bulb have about 50% of chances to survive. And actually, the survival would depend on what's happened to the connections of these cells.
Right, but once they survive?
Once they survive, they stay forever. Yeah.
And then the second question to the, so the striatum is only one point in the human which is known to receive new cells. Is this because it's only found there, or did people check everything?
Well, they've been checking everywhere, in the striatum, in the cortex, of course in the olfactory bulb, because there was a kind of fight for a long time. The only places in let's say, constitutive neurogenesis, so there is no brain injuries, this is where you can find these newborn neurons in the striatum. Now, with strokes, and there are other, maybe other diseases that probably could bring newborn neurons in other places. Mm-hmm. But so far, the constitutive neurogenesis in human beings concern both hippocampus and the striatum.
Thank you.
All right.
I was wondering if you can keep asking, but I just wonder, like, there's a lot of these are just simple factual questions. People should just maybe Google. I don't want to be mean, but I think you should decide.
I think I'm fine because actually, if you don't understand my first slide, I mean, I'm
yeah.
it's good that you.
Questions.
Yeah, no. I mean, after all, we have plenty of time.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. When
I mean, we have a picnic around 3 o'clock. You said. Deadline.
They will stay too, based on this.
Yes.
Sorry, I was confused. You said that once they survive, they stay forever. The newborn cells, once they survive at 52 weeks, they stay forever. But then you said that they're replaced.
So other have to die. So I mean, of course, obviously, the olfactory bulb is not growing.
So they do not stay forever. They will die at some point and be replaced by new ones.
Yeah. If I have some chance, maybe I will grab some slides that I didn't thought to bring in this issue of this is very critical decision for the survival and death decision. It's very important. But
PMA, maybe it's important to say that I think your point is that the survival is probably non-random.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not sort of replacement.
Yeah.
All these numbers are statistics. So there may be some neuron which, you know, always dies or always stays long.
The arrival of these neurons is completely random. And then there are very important signals to arrive. I mean, these newborn neurons, like we take a definition coming from physicists, they are acting as coincident detectors with both inputs from the dendrites and somatic connection from top-down informations. So that from now, what you just have to take into account. It's two inputs. Right? Maybe the last question for the introduction, yes?
Sure. So, I mean, I like the idea that Australia was one focus of humans, and why do you have newborn neurons in so few places? You know, if this is a good thing, why doesn't it happen in everyone?
Yeah, I mean, this question of why, I try to avoid, I try to explain more how, but why, you know, I don't know. To be honest, I mean, I don't know what, maybe this is something we should discuss the coming days, actually, of in terms of computation, what kind of function these newborn neurons could bring to the circuit that any given pre-existing neurons is not able to fulfill, maybe. So these are the questions that probably I would like also to ask for the theoreticians.
Ask one more.
So this is like...
Now, I'm green here, you know.
Placement in the olfactory bulb is a rolling specific phenomenon? I mean, how widely is it?
Actually, no, it has been being carefully looked at different other animals, and it's not only a rodent unique features. But interestingly, when you come to do this kind of comparison across different animals, you know, people thought that, okay, if these newborn neurons are very important to give better, to process information in a better way, let's say, then if you take a bat, and if you're thinking about spatial memory, hippocampus of these animals should really be full of newborn neurons. And if there is one species where you don't find other neurogenesis in the hippocampus, is bats. So really, you know, you should not expect so much things coming from this other neurogenesis. I mean, at least it's not obvious. Right. So, just to give milestone to my presentations, there are some people who believe that to understand the meaning of life, you have to go and dig into the most unique elements for geneticists, genes. So I guess you know who have said that, the Nobel Prize.
We saw the pictures, it's Francis, no?
Yeah, so. That's Francis, in one hand, who said that, you know, if you want to understand, you have to dig and get the unique elements, the more simple elements. And then you have the opposite approaches. which is science is either physics or stamp collecting. Who has said that? Exactly. Right, so I think this spirit of this meeting is really to bridge these two opposite ideas, and I really would like to do this kind of things today. And not trying to do too much stamp collecting, so not to bring too much data, but just as you did so far, promoting discussions, debates, and hopefully you will not agree with me. So,
that's a great goal. I like it already.
Right. So I would like to hint three parts of this presentation. The first one will be dedicated to these newborn neurons linked with plasticity in the circuits. We see that these new guys arriving into circuits will probably bring some features that the pre-existing neurons are not able to fulfill. After that, we will see that these outputs, the signals coming from the newborn neurons, are quite different from the pre-existing ones. And finally, we will see, as we have been addressed already, that the fact that these newborn neurons arrive into the circuits, they will make some unique connections. And one of the major connections they will make is with some top-down fibers, and we will see that they are mostly connected with the AON or the piriform cortex. So let's go first to the role of newborn neurons with learning, memory, let's say plasticity in a more general sense. So for those who are not familiar with the olfactory bulb, but I guess I should skip now this slide. I'm coming too late for this meeting. But just to remind you, at least when I'm talking about replacing newborn neurons, you should be aware that there are two places where neurons are going to die and be replaced. One is in sensory organ, where you have sensory neurons that are going to die from time to time. It's about every 2 months. And these sensory neurons will be produced by truly stem cells. And here, we know more or less that these stem cells will receive some signals from dying sensory neurons. So other neurogenesis within the olfactory epithelium is quite easy to guess in terms of functional meanings. It's just a matter of repairing. You have a dying neurons sending signals, and a given stem cells will produce a sensory neurons to replace the previous one. But now, when we jump into the olfactory bulb, then, as I said, we're going to see that these granule cells and PG cells are going to be replaced, and guessing what are the functional meanings is a little bit more complex. But for this presentation, I'd just like to remind you that we should have these canonical microcircuits in mind, where we have the mitral cells or tough cells, whatever you want. These neurons are going to be considered in my presentation as a kind of scaffold. They're not going to be replaced. And amazingly, everything connecting to this scaffold is going to be replaced. Either these are the sensory neurons, or the PG cells, or these granule cells. But this is the cells that will be produced during embryogenesis, and will stay forever. And all these neurons connecting to this scaffold are going to be subjected to a replacement. And now we're going to see how these neurons will find their paths to make the connections, and how they're going to know to which neurons they have to connect, and how they're going to be selected, or they're going to die. For that, we have chosen a kind of classical protocol. We are injecting viruses into the subventricular zones, and if we are patient enough, like here, about 3 weeks later, we have all these green cells are newborn neurons, and then we can patch a given green cells here to investigate what kind of function, what kind of feature this newborn neuron is now expressing. Just to give you an idea of these cells migrating into the olfactory, I mean into this, what we call that, the rostral migratory stream here. It takes about 2 days from the place of birth to the olfactory bulb. It takes about 2 days. And within this stream, you can see cells. We don't know why. The majority goes toward the olfactory bulb. So the subventricular zone will be here. But as you can see, some cells are going backwards. So most of the cells going forwards and other cells going backwards. So we don't know what these cells are looking for. But at some point, they will go back and find the olfactory bulb where they're going to integrate. So this is to give you an idea of the time scale here. So you have the migratory cells, and then they turn to left, and then they're going to receive synaptic contact. I will show you that in the next slide, that the first synaptic contact these cells are receiving are GABAergic inputs, and they are not excitatory. They are inhibitory, because at the same time, for the excitatory, you will have AMPA receptors, and so it's not as it has been described during embryogenesis or during brain development, where you have these silent synapses with NMDA responses. Here you have the AMPA responses and GABAergic inhibitory inputs very early. And a bit later on, about 2 weeks and later on, then the cells are able to speak. What is important here, so keep in mind that the cells are listening first. They receive synaptic contact before speaking.
Unlike us.
Right. And like also what's happened during development, actually. This is what I wanted to show you, that adult neurogenesis is not a kind of neotenic features. Neotenic features in biology means a kind of juvenile traits that you keep all your life. In other words, adult neurogenesis is not a long-lasting brain development. It's a very is a process that is unique. For instance, the way that these cells are receiving synaptic contacts for 2 weeks before being able to release neurotransmitters is quite unique. And also, as I said, for the maturation of AMPA receptors, AMPA synapses with GABAergic synapses is also unique. It's not recapitulating embryogenesis. Questions?
Yes? To this migration, so is it either spread out over the olfactory bulb or is it somehow?
Yeah, it's as was pointed out by Venki. Yeah, the cells are arriving randomly. There is one key molecule. I'm not going into details, but there is a gradient here. There is a molecule that is called tenascin, and tenascin is going to be released by mitral cells mostly, and is activity-dependent released. And so it's randomly, but of course these newborn neurons will be attracted to some places within the bulb where there is more activity, obviously. This is just to show you one of the features we were able to record about here, 2 weeks, for 2 weeks old cells, GABAergic responses, and the take-home message, because we are using flux animals, this was to show that these GABAergic inputs are mediated by alpha-2 GABAergic subunits. But the very important point was shown a few years ago already, when we were looking at synaptic plasticity for these newborn neurons. And we have been looking at several glutamatergic inputs, distal ones, proximal ones, for the intrinsic circuits, and couldn't find any plasticity. Even though those cells, those GABAergic interneurons, are expressing all the machinery to support classical synaptic plasticity, PSD95, AMPA, NMDA, I mean, all the usual suspects as expressed, and we couldn't find any synaptic plasticity except when we were able to stimulate centricule fibers, glutamatergic centricule fibers. And as it's shown here, you can see we were able to initiate this so-called LTP, the long-term program. Just kidding. Just kidding. This was a private joke for Chuck. Yes?
So how are the chloride bound development on these granule cells? So you know that there is this idea that...
Yeah, the switch and
NKC. The guys actually might be excitatory for a while. So these newborn cells, do they go to that GABA's excitatory...
The switch.
They switch
immediately. As soon as the cells are getting out of this migratory stream, and then we have this KCC2 pump express. So there is a kind of need of GABAergic being excitatory instead of being inhibitory when cells are migrating.
But once they arrive?
And once, arrive into the bulb, arrive into the circuits, but once they arrive into the olfactory bulb, then they have to make this turn, 90-degree turn, and then KCC2 is expressed, and GABA turn to be inhibitory.
So this input that comes really early is going to be inhibitory?
Yes, correct. While it's excitatory, because all migrating cells are expressing GABA, and they release GABA through a kind of a non-vesicular release, and this GABA is going to be more excitatory and maybe helping the cells to migrate, actually. When we knock down the NKCC1, we slow down the migratory speed. So long-term program, LTP. I'm not going into detail, but I mean, this is to show you that the maintenance of this LTP is presynaptically, but the induction is postsynaptic. In other words, if you record a given newborn neurons with high calcium buffer, for instance, you prevent any calcium rise within these neurons, you don't get LTP.
And I forget, how does the strength of it in the young granule cells compare to the older granule cells?
So this is the next slide. In fact, over time, you know, these are the age of the cells, weeks post-injection, so 2 weeks. This is the maximum of LTP we can get. 8 weeks. 12 weeks with 3 months old newborn neurons, you get like the similar features that we could get in a non-GFP cell, which means a pre-existing one. So it's very interesting that these newborn neurons bring unique features into the circuits. When they arrive, when they are young, they will change the probability of glutamate release from these centricular fibers. Remember, I told you induction is post and maintenance is pre. And so there is an increase of probability of glutamate release. But interestingly, as soon as the neurons are going to mature over time, then this LTP decreases. And there is a very nice correlation between the probability of survival and the magnitude of LTP.
And here 100% means no change.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this is a buzzer line.
I thought didn't Ben Strobridge find cases in which you can get LTP?
He never checked whether they're at. You should ask.
Yeah. No, go ahead. No, but he was recording at very young animals, between 2 and 3 weeks.
Right. Okay.
And I guess this is what we are looking here exactly.
So, but generically, then these synapses are just stronger in the older animals.
This is something we haven't been looking at carefully. If comparing the synaptic strengths of these inputs with other glutamatergic inputs, I don't know. We haven't been doing a careful comparison between all these. I mean, let's say, So I should say they are for everyone here, the discussions. We have three different glutamatergic inputs, extrinsic to the olfactory bulb, and intrinsic because here you have collateral from axon, from the mitral cells, and then you have the distal ones, okay, from the dendrites. So 1, 2, and 3. So I don't remember, but we haven't been carefully measuring the synaptic strengths in comparing with the others' synaptic strengths. I would say yes, I think, but I'm not sure about that. Actually, I don't have any very careful quantification. Right, so far I've been talking about the synaptic inputs. These cells, once they arrive, they need to integrate, so they will make synaptic contacts. But if you are wondering what is the meaning, what is the impact of this arrival of newborn neurons, you don't have to look for synaptic inputs, but you have to look for the output. And here we have a very nice tool as everyone is using now, optogenetic, of course, because then you can inject this plasma to express channel rhodopsin in the stem cells or in the progeny before they become neurons. And then, because we are far from the place of birth, then we can shed light into the olfactory bulb and be sure we're going to activate only newborn neurons. As it's shown here, for instance, we can record blindly any mitral cells and record a nice light evoked synaptic responses. Okay, so before to go into detail about the circuitry, we're going to jump into now into the behavior, where we're going to ask the mice to have this hat here, and we're going to deliver light with this head-fixed LED, or sometimes in other experiments we would use the optic fibers. And I'm going to show you now the impact of activating newborn neurons in a very simple task, go-no-go task, when animal will have to recognize some odorants associated with the rewards and others that will not be associated with reward. So animal in this case have to refrain to go to the water port. And here, if the animal recognizes odorants, the animal will have to go to the water port. Okay, so for the physicist, I'm showing you the real life. We'll see the animals. So this is just to explain to you the photobeams here. When you will see these green dots mean peppermint, for instance, animals have to know that this is now the odor associated with the rewards. When animals smell peppermint and refrain, this would be the miss. You will see a red cross on the movie. Now, if we expose the animal to strawberry, for instance, and he goes to drink, false alarms. And now, if the animal smells strawberries and doesn't go to drink, this will be a correct rejection. So let's see what's happened now. You're going to see the mouse with the sled here, the odor ports, and this is the water delivery. Okay, we're starting, so the animal is going randomly, and you will see in all cases going to drink, actually, so even though he should not sometime. Here we are 3 out of 6. Now, he should not drink, you see. Okay, false, another false, and so on and so far. So we started first because we are in France with pastis and eucalyptus. Very easy task. When you do that, either you shed light into the brain of the animals or you don't. You know, this is a learning curve. You go, you start to 50%, and these are the number of trials. You repeat, you repeat, you repeat, and you see the percentage of correct responses going up. In the control cases, or if you shed light, you don't improve anything. Now let's go to more difficult task, peppermint versus mint. Very diluted concentrations. As you can see on the black curves here, you go and you start, you know, after 15 trials, the animal is still at the chance level. And then the animal starts to understand the rule and goes up. But if you shed light now, what you can observe here in these curves, like 10 to 15 trials, the animal is quite pretty good now. And they are good learners. And they reach the maximum when the control animal are starting to learn. This is another way to represent the results. These are the number of blocks the animal need to repeat to reach the what we call 80% the correct responses level. And if the task is easy, you don't need, I mean, if you shed light, you don't improve anything. But if you are now in a difficult task, when the animals in control cases need about 25, 26 trials, blocks, sorry, they need only about 12 here when you activate newborn neurons. Yes?
Is this a consequence of stimulating newborn neurons or stimulating brain cells? So if you disinfect...
Yeah, in our case, I mean, we cannot really discriminate. I should say stimulation of adult bone neurons because we are activating both granule cells and PG, even though out of the population, 90% is granule cells. We cannot really...
Sorry, I don't mean granule cells. Is this a consequence of activating inhibitory neurons? So if you were to just inject the lenti channel into the bulb and infect all neurons as opposed to specifically the newborn neurons?
Okay. We're going to see this in another slide where we turn around the questions and inject the plasmid, the channel rhodopsins, into newborn neurons for pups and after birth. And then we're going to wait, the animal get older. So that will be another way to do the job. Yes?
You're just illuminating the whole olfactory bulb. There's no special specificity.
No.
So how many days before were the virus, so at which stage are these newborn neurons?
In these cases, these newborn neurons were about 1 month old.
1 month old.
So those are the ones that are surviving after arriving into the bulb.
I see.
So, yes?
How many neurons are those, like, surviving after 1 month?
Okay, so we have been trying to quantify, for instance, with these experiments by shedding lights, how much neurons get activated. So we have been using CIFOS. I mean, it's maybe not really a very acute proxy, but we had like 3% of all the newborn neurons being showing CIFOS expression at least. And so the question is, do we need only to activate 3% of the population of newborn neurons to get this increase, or there is something that is not really, we can't detect with CIFOS. This is something I don't know. We have been doing kind of similar experiments four or five years ago using SVAD to prevent any, to go into you the questions, to prevent cell death. So you can use a kind of anti-apoptotic drugs called SVAD. And when we did that, we in fact the olfaction of these animals was decreasing. The reaction time was longer, and they were not able to perform difficult tasks. So in some way, we need to eliminate some of these newborn neurons. Maybe the ones that are older, that it's, you know, you have these critical windows where cells are expressing LTP or plasticity, and then after that, this form of plasticity decrease. So we don't know. But if we promote survival of these newborn neurons, for sure, olfaction is not better. It's worse. Okay, we could even make, unfortunately for these mice that were subjected to these behavioral experiments, we sacrifice them later on. And you know, after out of these learners, these good learners, we have a range of animals being better learners than the other ones, and they are shown here. And interestingly, we could show these correlations or anti-correlations between the density of channel rhodopsin expressing cells and the criterion. With a higher density, you need less block to reach these criterions. So to come back to the question that was addressed before, I'm also something I should have said at the beginning. I'm interleaving here figures between published data and unpublished. So this is unpublished, and I like to get you feedback. What I should have said before, to get this improvement of learning, we were shedding lights anytime, whether the animal was smelling S plus or S minus. And after that, we were starting to wonder, could we get a specific effect whether the animal is exposed to S plus or S minus? What is important? And so we repeat these experiments a few months ago, and we find that, in fact, we get this improvement when animals was exposed to S plus and shedding light at the same time, as you can see here. When we were exposing animal to S minus, whether you shed light or not doesn't do anything. So this is very important for us now, because these newborn neurons are able to detect the fact that these animals are smelling S plus, and at least the newborn neurons are able to discriminate whether this is a S plus or S minus odorants. Yes?
Can you clarify, was the light on just during training, or during training and testing, or just during testing?
Just during testing.
I see. So they learned the odor. So they had to build the association, the absence of this light. But then when you were...
No, sorry. So we shed light here during odor presentations.
Yeah.
And this is something we were going to see later on. For instance, if we delay the late pulses, like after this 500 milliseconds, we don't get any improvement. So you really need to both expose the animal to odors, because they are sniffing is in this first time window, about this 500 milliseconds. And then you repeat this. Every time you repeat. But as I said, initially when you start this protocol, we were shedding lights at any time, S plus or S minus.
I mean, maybe another way to say it is, every time they got S plus, was there also light? Or did you insert some catch trials where you left out the light that still presented S plus?
No, every time the animal was smelling S plus.
So I mean, that leaves two possibilities. One is they're learning the odor, and the second is that they're learning light versus non-light, right? And
yes.
Of course, the fact that it doesn't have that effect when you learn the S minus is already evidence against that hypothesis.
Right. But actually, I will like, maybe I will, during this afternoon a break or whatever, I will dig and find, again, something that is... We are just getting these results a few weeks ago. By shedding lights into the animal without giving orders, S plus, the animal was going to the reward. So there is like something that just activating newborn neurons with lights,
yeah,
they then trigger behavior and the right responses.
And you can get the converse, like exactly 5% of the time you could have a catch trial with just odor and
yeah,
no light,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, yeah.
But can I read the control here? That is the non-general of the injected animals.
That's right. These are the animals with the lead implanted, but no viruses.
Exactly.
No.
So it's not, they can't. So if you say, what you're saying is they learn light versus no light, then
yeah,
these animals should learn the same way. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
They can learn light through neurons.
Through the
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are multiple mechanisms by which you can.
Which seems to be the case.
Yes, right.
Which seems to be the case.
Yep,
right. Yep. So here are another way to represent the data. Here are the control cases, the black ones here. And when you deliver light only on S plus, you get this improvement. And on S minus, you don't get anything.
But I mean that alone already is good evidence that that there's something about the odor that matters. So that, I mean, were you surprised by that result? I mean, that's a pretty remarkable result.
What we are trying to bridge now is that there is probably in the real life, the animal don't do not receive light, of course, in the newborn neurons, but the top-down processes would do the job.
The 40 hertz, that's somewhat critical, or it doesn't matter much?
10 hertz doesn't do anything. So 10 hertz at the same time, at the same time window that I was showing you before, 40 hertz, 10 hertz does not do at all any improvement, as you can see here. And as I alluded before, if you deliver light at 40 hertz, but now with a delay, you also don't get any improvement. There is so this requirement of getting an excitation of newborn neurons at 40 hertz with light, at least light delivery at 40 hertz, at simultaneously when animal is exposed to odorants. Yes?
So how does this 10 and 40 hertz compare to the actual firing rate of granule cells during this type of
What do you record? What kind of frequency do you record in a live animals?
0 hertz.
No, in non-anesthetized. Non-anesthetized.
Yeah, or hence very few granule cells spike at all when you wake.
No, majority of task. Shit, can I report a lot?
But this is what my next system. This is passive. We haven't recorded. Recorded during a behavior task from granule cells. Much as yes, and there is a huge difference between awake passive and active, but not granule cells. So we don't.
Yeah, but during
ODA,
I don't know what the frequency
of GCAMP gave you any data?
Well, I think it's just, Takaki and Jeff Isaacson, right? The claim is awake is much stronger in a way. It's not that much stronger, it's a little bit more.
They
published it.
They haven't done the calibration of what 1 df over f means.
Correct. Yeah. Not only I think the Shea is a little bit, or I think it's true, but I think it's a little bit overemphasized.
It's small n.
And the question is, delivering light at 40 hertz doesn't mean that the granule cells are also firing at 40 hertz.
Can I ask a different question? So when I read this paper, I was struck, you know, how do you choose 40 hertz? You know, it's just it was a random lab with 40
No,
hertz.
No.
What's the logic?
No, because a guy, a postdoc, former postdoc in my lab, but now he's a staff member, Gabriel Lepouzet, for those who know him, was recording gamma. I mean, we were also working on gamma rhythms and beta rhythms. So that the idea was, okay, let's try 10 and 40 hertz. The rationale was behind beta and gamma rhythm.
But gamma is 56 years, we learned before.
Well,
beta is. what's special about
30 to 90? Let's agree.
Let's agree on the broad.
And the rationale also is a limitation of the channel rhodopsin per se as well. I mean, we couldn't go faster.
Yeah,
so 40 hertz. I mean, also we didn't have any. We were not patient enough maybe to try a
whole run. So you were lucky to get an effect. Right?
Yes, not lucky.
We try
10 hertz and initially we got nothing. We try several frequency until we find going upper, actually, going higher, 40 hertz.
In hippocampus there are some probably efforts in use of TP, is there a difference?
In vivo, I don't know.
I'm sure that people do it. I just like.
But I guess what context? I'm sure people do it. I mean, Matt Wilson, for example, shone light on different phases of data to do it during. But I'm not sure.
During.
I mean, isn't there the Michael Heuser, the CFOS activator? I'm trying to remember. You know, okay.
Tony Allen.
Okay.
So
you're
shedding
the
different
pages.
I think
it's
hippocampus, but not
Wilson.
Newborn.
Oh, you mean newborn neurons?
No, just like.
No, it's lectin, yeah.
But I guess what's relevant also is that you change the way so granule cells become far less fast in their proliferation. So that's a big difference between.
I mean, this is probably, yes, a good point for general discussions that maybe this simulations through lights make them more reliable.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the reasons why we get this improvement of learning.
Also,
yeah?
You're giving a half-second prank beginning, the
yeah.
other last 2 seconds. Have you recorded from the bulbs during and actually specifically maybe after the light prank? I mean, could this just be a reset such that inputs that are coming in out afterwards?
Yeah.
Basically resetting the question.
Yeah, no, we haven't been recording the olfactory bulb responses
yeah.
At the same time.
Well, it's also the plasticity doesn't matter just on the postsynaptic firing rate. That happens on the relative relationship between the presynaptic firing rate and the postsynaptic firing rate. So that it's not only maybe a match with what the granule cells are doing, but it probably also matches what the rest of the olfactory circuit is doing and what the presynaptic inputs coming into that cell are also doing. There's your probability of strengthening or weakening of synapse really depends on the combination of the presynaptic and postsynaptic firing rate. So just knowing what happens here on the postsynaptic side is only half the story.
Sure. So the beauty would be to record
everybody else.
Mostly my tracer, I guess.
Except when you shine light, you could entrain the whole circuit.
I'm going maybe to show this if I have time. okay, the thing is, after doing this kind of learnings, you improve learning, okay? In France, we take summer vacations, never less than 50 days. So this is a vacation time. Okay? So people leave the lab. Animals were trained before we go for vacations. We went to everywhere. And then we come back after this. And then we ask the animal, do you remember what you have been learning? And so, as you can see here, sorry?
You ask the students?
And the beauty that not only you can boost learning, but then when you add the animals in control cases, they're like 60%, and you have an improvement by just shedding light. They remember what they have been trained 50 days before. So that's related to one of the questions I had before. What's happened if you stimulate the pre-existing ones? We address the questions a bit similar in a similar way, but we inject here the viruses in pups. They were like P6 pups and wait the same time, like a month later. And we have to adjust the quantity of viruses we have to inject to get the same number of neurons into the olfactory bulb. So this is shown here. So we have to adjust a lot of things because obviously the brain is not the same. But at the end, we could find the same density. And then when we shed light at any given, I'm just showing here 40 hertz, but you can see now that you don't improve learning.
Sorry, how old are the animals when you do the behavioral
testing? So they were like between 1 and 2 months old animals. So there is something that seems to be unique to be born during adult life and not just after birth, for instance. So we have been recording granule cells. When I say we, I mean Gabi, for those who knows him. And of course, if you shed light into granule cells, you will expect that you could get an inhibition. And indeed, you can get those responses by having a duration increased. You inhibit more mitral cells. We could, so this is a frequency of mitral cells before and after light delivery. And nicely, you can see here this notion of dose responses. So you see, Dima, we've been using a lot of range and frequencies. We didn't stick to only 40 hertz. And so nicely, you can see these nice dose responses. And because we were able to record several mitral cells at the same times, we could observe that only at 40 Hz we were synchronizing neighbor mitral cells. And if we give light at 10 Hz, neighbor mitral cells were not really more synchronized before. Sorry?
How long is the pulse?
In these cases, I think it was 10 milliseconds here. This is the kind of inhibition we can get. Or you can see it here, actually.
But the pulse is repeated for many times.
It's repeated. Yeah. And so you compare the occurrence of getting spikes, you can nicely get these nice oscillations between between neighbor cells.
So did you got this only in newborn cells, or what result would you expect in an old, if you simulate not newborn cells? The one that you injected in pups?
Yes, we haven't...
Remarkable if pups shows exactly the same thing but no learning. Then it's actually because...
We decorate the two things, yes.
Yes, because currently maybe the activity would evoke learning rather than... So maybe there's a different physiological effect of the newborn granular cells on that.
Yeah.
On that. But so it's not that granular cells help learning, but that specific
feature, yeah.
And
yeah.
You cannot evoke this feature with an old granular cell. But if you can evoke this feature with an old granular cell, that tells that the newborn granular cells is much more, have some special role.
To be done.
And the synchronous fire, the regular firing, that's it looks like it's locked to the frequency of stimulation, is that right?
Right, yes, correct. Okay.
And 66 Hz looks similar?
Yes. I'm not sure about that. I will, because this was like a supplementary figure. So, but it was quite similar. Yes. So, to summarize this first part, first of all, we have seen that activating newborn neurons increase learning, discrimination learning, but only when the task is difficult. So. You have to think these newborn neurons as a kind of brain reservoir. You know, if the task is easy, you don't need them. It's like attention, you know. But if the task is quite difficult, then it's very useful to engage those newborn neurons. And we have seen that these newborn neurons, when we shed light, are not acting just as a gatekeeper, but they could synchronize output neurons.
It relates to Vimal's point about frequency and that you have this specific effect with 40 Hz. I can't remember what was the frequency that you thought was the proper gamma oscillation.
It was like the neuron paper.
Yeah. So I wondered whether there's some difference in the resonance frequency or so.
Yeah, I think it was the same, more or less frequency. It was like 35, between 35 and 50. It was. All right. So we have seen that these adult-generated, adult-born neurons are quite unique, especially if you compare to the early-born neurons. Are they different in their unique intrinsic properties? I will not show you the data. I will say no. No differences. No differences in targeting the mitral cells. But we're going to see that the synaptic transmission between the newborn neurons and the mitral cells is quite different. To address this question, this was done by Matt Valle, who is now at the Alan Brain Atlas, Brain Institute, sorry. you can see him slices. So to really work on what kind of differences these newborn neurons are showing compared to the pre-existing one, he has been working with electrical stimulations and compare with light evoked responses. Let's start first with electrical stimulation. So when we wake up the synapses, going from 1 to 5 to 7 millimolar of extracellular calcium concentration, you wake up the synapses, and after that you add baclofen and you shut down. You reduce the probability of a neurotransmitter release. But now, when we are doing the same thing with light evoked responses, as you can see here, so again, we can wake up the synapses here, but these cells are insensitive to baclofen, so they are escaping to inhibitions. You can't reduce...
Sorry, your electrical simulation is, where is the electrical simulation placed?
Well, we place in the EPL, and we record mitral cells, and we evoked any kind of GABAergic inputs coming from any... A proportion of these evoked responses obviously will be also coming from other bone neurons, but I would say the majority should be pre-existing granule cells, and we have this sensitivity to baclofen that we have been not able to see under light evoked responses.
And those are inhibitory currents?
These are GABAergic responses recorded from mitral cells.
So this is an annoying question. But you're activating the terminals, right?
Sorry?
You're activating the terminals.
Yes.
Have you tried activating the somata of the granule cells rather than the terminals directly?
With light or with electrical simulation?
No, with light.
With light, yeah.
So I think there's action potential independent release from the...
Yeah, so the only way to, keeping these configurations, applying TTX, will be nice to see whether we are blocking or not the light evoked responses. But in these experiments, we haven't been checking that, so I can't understand. I can't reply to your questions. Yeah, I would say it's baclofen insensitive. Now, whether it's coming from a lack of control of action potential or not, this is not shown here.
But where do you, the baclofen is activating after the presynaptic terminals?
Yeah, but yeah, actually.
So that's the endpoint, regardless of the spiking or terminal.
Right, and maybe one way to address also this question is the lack of, when you record granule cells, And you apply baclofen, you don't see any change in the membrane potentials. I would say probably there is no effect on the soma. And here, what we have been doing is comparing newborn neurons born at P6 versus newborn neurons born at the adult life, as is shown here. So P6 and you wait, or P16 and you wait. And as you can see here, with electrical responses, you have the control, then you add baclofen, and of course you can reverse with CGP. And this is with electrical responses, or if you have P6, you get the same kind of features, and we lose this sensitivity, as I said, with other bone neurons.
Yeah, so that sort of answers Kevin's question anyway, right?
Yeah. So the point is here to say that the other bone neurons are expressing long-term potentiation for glutamatergic inputs, especially for those who are coming from the olfactory cortex. These newborn neurons release inhibition that will escape to GABA-B signaling, at least at the presynaptic terminals, and there is no time to discuss about that. Well, maybe I will use this now for a transition with associative connectivity when I'm going to show you the top-down control.
Quick factual question for sure. Other people. The cortical fugal, the centrifugal inputs to granule cells, are they also GABA-B sensitive?
Yeah.
They are. So that actually just occurs to me, all of us doing terminal imaging, calcium imaging, if you have action potentials, but if you just do GABA-B, then you'll see less calcium. Anyway,
that's
a tangential thing. Yeah.
It's a good discussion.
Good point, right?
All right. So here I'm now going to, in my third part of the presentation, I'm going to talk about this cortical feedbacks in pigeon into the other bone neurons. But of course, they are also going to reach some short axon cells. And therefore, you have a very nice design to express STDP, the spike time independent plasticity, because you have these glutamatergic inputs followed by a feedforward inhibition. This is a work in progress where we could show into these newborn neurons the expression of potentiations or depressions according to the timing when the cells is spiking versus the EPSP coming from the cortical inputs. And again, now to link my first part and of the presentation with shedding light into the newborn neurons, as I show you, and improving learning. And I would like to show you that is about shedding light into this cortical feedback would do the same job. And as is shown here by Gabby recordings here, we shed light into these centriole fibers, you get inhibitions. And when we shed light directly to the granule cells that are now light sensitive, again, you get the same inhibition of the mitral cells. So we're going to subject animals to learnings, and we're going to look what's happened to this glutamatergic contact from the cortical fibers. When we use the Tibet animals to labels all these intrinsic glutamatergic inputs, as you can see here, these are the dendrites of the mitral cells. And you have here the IPL sustain. So these are the connection for the local glutamatergic input into these newborn neurons. And nicely, when you inject now this with channel rhodopsin and cherry into the olfactory cortex, AWEN and the anterior piriform cortex, you get this area for proximal. So you have very nicely two layers without cross or superimposition. So you have two places where you have intrinsic inputs and extrinsic inputs. So we, yes?
Technical question, can you go back? So how the APC does project to the glomerular layer. So why, so you say that there are way more axons.
Much more action. You have a gradient actually, yeah, from the deep portion of the granule cell layer as you're going to go. So you have really two opposite gradients, as you can see here.
Okay, but they are axons.
Especially from AON, I think there's much more than
into the glomerular layer, right?
I would like to suggest it's a pyramid. It's a gradient, and what we're going to see now is what's happened along the dendritic arborizations. Where are going to be the changes when you're going to look glutamatergic inputs onto the different spines? And we're going to see that there is indeed a gradient. So the learning protocol will be very simple. Animal will have to associate the reward with odors. Some animals we never get the reward, so they will be only odor exposed animals, and then we have air exposed animals. And here are the changes. So if you look along these dendritic arborizations, as you can see here, the major places where you see, so these are the olfactory learning animals, odor learning animals, and these are the higher spine density. So you get changes into these proximal regions of the newborn neurons after only 1 week of training. After showing there was an increase of spine density, we have been looking at these both GABAergic inputs as well as glutamatergic inputs with PSD95 and Gefrin, to find that there were an increase of both GABAergic and glutamatergic contact into these areas. And when looking at spontaneous events, only the frequency was increased, not the amplitudes, for GABAergic inputs, and the trend, but this was not significant for the spontaneous glutamatergic events. Well, I'm going to skip the electronic microscopy. And now we're going to look at recording a given newborn neurons. What's happened if you shed light into the centricular fibers? No change in the ratio maximum to minimums here. So, sorry, we did like minimum stimulations and get these step functions. So by increasing the duration of light delivery, you get this synaptic light evoked synaptic responses. And as you can see here, with these experiments, we could observe an increase of the minimum responses in the older learning groups compared to air exposure or just controls. So learning increases spine density, restricted into an area where these newborn neurons receive glutamatergic contact coming from the peripheral cortex. And what I'm going to show you now in the ongoing works is that we are looking at the kind of feature these spines are showing when we are recording newborn. So finally, I should really thank the people who have been doing the job, the collaborators, Charles Greer for the electronic microscopy. I should say all the optogenetics works that we have been doing in the labs was initially started in Venki Labs when I was spending my summer time over there. And Jean-Marc Fritchie has been working with us on the different GABAergic subunits, alpha 2 subunits mostly. And so this is it. And this is a view I have from my office. Welcome, Pozok. Yes.
So what you saw is that there was an increase of the spine density that was closer to the soma of the granule cell, but on that image that you show how the granule cell developing, there seems to be a lot of growth. It's at the distal part where some other kind of input. So it's, but when you have that growth, you don't have increasing spine density.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a kind of decorrelation between the dendritic length and the dendritic growth and the spine dynamics. And actually, this process of the dendritic length, which is going, and then I skip one of the slides, but there were some pruning, and then you reach a steady state. So this is like it's conformed to what we know about brain developments. And during development, you have this dendritic pruning over time, and the time window is the same to what have been described during development. But in terms of spine density and spine dynamics, these two events are completely different. I mean, they don't occur at the same time
so
windows.
The third one that occurs is this increase in spine density close to the stoma.
Yeah.
And then after that, then there start this branching.
Absolutely, in the EPL.
Okay. So, I know these are tedious controls, but I don't see you showing like existing resident granule cells sort of doing the same kind of spine dynamics and counting. That presumably you've done that, you don't see anything?
Yeah, absolutely. In these experiments, we have been injecting two viruses to look at different two populations, the green and the red ones. And in fact, yes, indeed, this is a very unique feature. And all my presentation was done in parallel, controlling with P6 versus P60, so early born versus late born neurons. And this high turnover is only due to the other born neurons and not the pre-existing ones. Yes.
I should probably know this. When you photostimulate the newborn neurons, do you promote their survival?
Yes, this was not done with optogenetic, but was done before with other exposure of animals. But indeed, yes.
But if you selectively activate just those cells,
no. Yeah, this was not done. So
what about Carlos Lewis? Didn't he use this MAGMAC?
No, he used, yes, actually, he showed that if you depolarize the cells with this MAGMAC, you promote survival. If you overexpress the potassium channels, you promote cell death. So it's tuned by activity, intrinsic membrane properties as well. I mean, according to the membrane potentials, you can promote survival or cell death.
More questions?
There's plenty of time, I think,
Emery, sure, sure.
For a few more days and weeks. And so and thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.